This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on November 20th, 2009, and today we're talking to Udi Dahan. Udi is calling us from Paris, which is very exciting. Udi, can you talk about who you are and what you do?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the show. And so my name's Udi Dahan. I'm an independent consultant that kind of flies around all over the place and helps companies with their scalability and availability woes. I'm also the founder of nServiceBus, which is the open source project that I think we're going to be talking about today. And that's really enough about me. And back over to you guys.
Okay. Well, as I was saying before the call, one of the things that just, I really enjoyed your recent, well, it wasn't that recent, but listening to you on .NET Rocks, and you were talking about some just scalability things that leverage the way that HTML, HTTP works. And for instance, you were talking about with Twitter, the idea of, you know, caching things out with XML.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that there are some things there where you were just explaining, kind of taking a step back from the scalability problems. People are so focused on their code as the scalability bottleneck. And so that just kind of really has had me thinking. And then since then, I've been listening to the Stack Overflow podcast. And they're running on ASP.NET on, I think, two servers. You know, their site has grown over time to over a million hits a day. And so they've been, you know, just discussing some of the things that they do as far as how they're making their system work. And, you know, it's, of course, when you listen to that sort of thing, you always, at least I do, I always backseat drive and I'll say, well, why'd you do that? I would have done this. And, you know, that sort of thing. So I wondered, is that they were talking about, for instance, that they were using a reverse proxy in order to handle session and in order to scale. And I was just wondering, you know, can you run a high availability site using two servers and ASP.NET?
Well, I guess the question is, how high is high? So that really is an issue when people talk about scalability. It's something of a numbers game. And besides all the scalability, there's the availability issues, which really becomes an issue of how large a scope you really want to look. So one of the big things that a lot of the larger sites are primarily concerned with is high availability first and foremost. So it doesn't really matter how fast your site could run if it were actually online when it's not. So the first step that they look at it is trying to set up that environment where, first of all, they have the ability to upgrade the site while it's still live, but not really having to take any part of the site down in order to upgrade it. And other parts of it is just due to all sorts of environmental conditions, power outages, storms, things like that, network connectivity issues that can make the site or parts of the site unavailable. The bigger the scope of the problem that you're looking to prevent, the more difficult it becomes. So what I mean by that is, in order to solve the availability issues, you end up having to copy data to a number of other locations so that if that machine goes down, you'll have a copy somewhere else. And it turns out that by trying to solve availability issues, you inherently make it more difficult to scale the site because you end up copying more data all over the place. You introduce more latency. So in that sense, high availability makes scaling more difficult rather than less difficult. The other part of it kind of has to do with just in general understanding what the behavior of your users of your site is. So what are they trying to use the site to achieve? A lot of sites similar to Stack Overflow, you have a relatively large number of users which are primarily reading information and a much smaller percent which are actually writing information. So that, similar to a lot of content sites, can be exploited in order to help make the site more scalable without making it very much more expensive. However, when you look at systems like Twitter, where the number of writers is fairly close to the number of readers, the patterns that would have worked for a content-based site just can't scale, not not in terms of the numbers Twitter is looking at, but rather the behavior. A lot of other social networks have those same sort of issues. So there isn't really a kind of one-size-fits-all solution. You need to understand what your site is doing, what its behavior is internally, how you look at upgrading it, how you look at modifying the content on your own, how your users contribute to the content, to really understand what characteristics can be exploited to make this a scale. But I'm afraid that there just isn't a single technology out there that just do X and all your scalability and availability problems go away. If only there were that company, you know, it's fairly close to the splitting the atom kind of breakthrough.
When you talked before about on that previous show on .NET Rocks, you had talked about the idea of splitting things apart. So updates come in and then you push out XML files that are cached for a time and that kind of thing. And then, you know, from that point of view, you can have your page becomes more of just a shell that then uses JavaScript or whatever to interact with a service that returns the content. And so does that sort of system also work for a mostly read type of site like Stack Overflow?
So what you get by splitting the site, or like maybe then preface that with what are the lines that you split your site along? So one of the problems that people have when trying to scale a system is that they tend to look at a page as a single thing. And seeing is that a page has lots of dynamic elements to it, some of them more volatile, that is, they change more often than others. And some of it even is personalized, which makes the ability to cache the entire page and use it for other users quite low. So the first step is really to rather than think of the page as sort of one big thing, look at the various pieces that make it up. So maybe you have like a category section or a tag cloud section that is dynamic by definition, but in practice probably doesn't change that much over the course of, say, an hour or even a day. So we could take that fragment of page and look at keeping the data separate from the rest of the page. That data is not personalized. So then we look at caching that data on a content delivery network and having that same fragment be served to all the users from the content delivery network rather than from our own servers. So by following the lines of volatility, those things that tend to change quickly and those things that tend to change slowly, and by the same token, the things which are personalized, splitting those off from the things which aren't personalized, we can take a page and have the same cache, slash the same file, the same resource, be served to millions of users off of a content delivery network without any of those readers ever hitting our site. So what that means is that rather than having to pay for that bandwidth ourselves, we are paying the content delivery network a much smaller rate for them to serve the data for us. So maybe I should just introduce or remind everybody that scalability is not actually a Boolean property of a system. It's not that it's either your system is scalable or it isn't. Scalability is a cost function. It's a multidimensional cost function. So you input into that function things like numbers of concurrent users, numbers of concurrent reads, writes, quantity of data, volatility of data, and then on the other end you get a number which is in dollars. So the smaller the cost is, the more scalable your site is. The less, in other words, the more cheaply you can support more users, more requests, more everything. So when going through that approach, what we end up doing is offloading a great deal of the reads in the system to something that can do it a lot more cheaply. That can be great for sites like Stack Overflow, which are very content-centric. And often, I think it's almost always in Stack Overflow, once content is created, it actually never changes. So when we look at a given question or a given comment or a given answer on Stack Overflow, we could look at providing that fragment of page with its own URI and then being able to cache that by itself, so that a page actually becomes just a set of links to resources that we'd get from other places. So while the page itself, the total number of links or all the list of links may change quite often when it's a hot topic of discussion and everybody's kind of talking about it and commenting, the data that was already created on that page is actually very static. So we can save quite a lot in terms of reads and serving bandwidth by moving that information off. But we still need to address the other side of it, is how do we handle these writes in a scalable way? That's a different challenge that this page partitioning doesn't help us with.
So as you do that kind of, you know, you also do open yourself up for potential maybe security issues or the wrong people seeing the wrong thing with that, right? As you start partitioning the page, you need to make sure that you're keeping on top of what you're caching and who it's cached for and that sort of thing.
The same would be true about anything related to security, right? You do have to think about what you're doing. There is no pattern or methodology that you can apply blindly to any kind of problem space, have it all solve your problems, either for scalability, availability, or security perspective. So yes, you do need to think about what you're caching and how you're exposing that. But other than that, it is a very powerful tool to have available to you when looking at addressing those kinds of issues. But by and large, like I said, when you divide up the page based on also personalization lines, that's when we start seeing things that are personal for a given user, you may not actually cache. But at that point, you're also talking about much smaller pieces of data that you are serving to a very smaller user population. So that has a very different scalability characteristic than, say, the rest of the content of a site. So you can be more security conscious on smaller pieces of data, and as a result of that, not have as big a scalability impact by keeping that personalization off the side.
Okay.
I'm curious, to what extent do you find that the sort of scalability choke points can be predicted, early in a product's life cycle? In other words, do you find sort of, you know, regular patterns where people make the same sort of scalability mistakes, or does it seem very dependent on the scenario and the usage of the product?
Well, the solution patterns tend to repeat themselves a lot. The mistakes are quite varied. So I wouldn't say that there's really anything that I could look at the mistakes people make and say you could have predicted that in advance. I do think that there are a certain set of characteristics that if you look for them in the product and you're aware of these patterns, you can avoid making all sorts of mistakes. One of them we already mentioned now was that you look at the content, which is broadly available to a large number of users, and you look at splitting off that content from the rest of the site in such a way that you can then cache that over the web, use content delivery networks like that. So that's a common one. There are others which are related to that, but that they kind of deal with the generation of the content. So there's this, so we can actually talk to this. You could expect to see this with Stack Overflow or very similar content creation sites, where while the user wants to receive immediate feedback for themselves, that the comment they posted, the answer they posted, the whatever, the rating that they gave, is visible right away. In other words, they want to see what they did. If that data isn't immediately available to all other users, then probably no one would be the wiser. And we could exploit that towards making the system scale more predictably across various load levels of writes. So what I mean by that is when we submit a comment on Stack Overflow, we could look at that as sending a message to a backend server saying, this is a comment that I'd like to post. The server on its end kind of looked at, is this a well-formed comment? Do I have all the permission that I need? And then it can respond back to you saying, yes, I've received your comment. And then the browser, which has all the data from your comment, can actually, via JavaScript, show it to you and say, your comment has been posted successfully. At that point in time, as a user, you're thinking, wow, that's great. My comment's been posted. And you go off to do other things. Whether that comment is immediately visible to all the other users of Stack Overflow is something that most users, when they're submitting a content, don't think about. They kind of assume that it is. But if it took another 5 seconds, 10 seconds, a minute, 5 minutes, probably nobody would know. And the site would continue to function and be all the better for scale because of it. So in that case, we could take all the various user-generated content, comments, answers, ratings, things like that, and queue them up on our backend servers so that we can process them at the rate that we find gives us the best throughput. So if the load is higher, having that sit around in the queue makes life easier for us. If the rate of messages coming in is low, then going through a queue may add just a little bit of latency, but nothing that actually would interfere with the functioning site. So a lot of things like that, when we can build a UI which captures all the information that we need from the user in one go and gives them that sort of thank you, we've got it covered, and even possibly showing the data in that own user's browser, is enough of a confirmation for the user to believe that the site has been updated, when actually we delay the update of the site to some point in time in the future where we can do that asynchronously.
So it's all about optimizing everything in the process, not just the one small thing that we're looking to, thinking about the whole system, not just thinking about one specific page or one update or whatever.
Well, I wouldn't call it optimizing it. I'd say that, to the previous question, dealing with large numbers of users that want to provide you with data. They're performing commands on your system. They're commenting, they're answering, they're rating things, all that kind of stuff. Even if you've been able to offload a bunch of reads, being able to scale to a large number of writes, is challenging on its own. So really that's what makes Stack Overflow and a lot of other content sites valuable. It's the fact that lots of users interact and actually state their mind on these sites. So that's pretty much all that Twitter is, right? It's people sending us new tweets. So that kind of thing, being able to handle the writes in a scalable way and not just reads, is really kind of the other side of the scalability coin. You can't say that you've built a scalable system if you don't have both. I will say that it is important to understand all properties of the system when making these decisions so that you don't complicate the architecture or the design of your site without getting any benefit on the other side. So introducing this kind of one-way messaging is less intuitive for a lot of developers. So crossing that learning curve is something that does take some time. So you want to make sure that you are investing in the right kind of patterns for your specific domain. But that being said, I've got to say that probably a lot more sites could benefit from these kinds of caching and messaging patterns rather than them trying to solve scalability on their own with various other, I don't know, database optimization techniques and multi-threading stuff that I've seen people do, which actually tends to really complicate things a lot, make them very brittle, and not that scalable anyway.
One thing that, you know, as you're talking about this, you're kind of in a way talking about, well, you are talking about a service-oriented architecture in a way where you are providing services to your web page that are accessed in a variety of ways, you know, potentially through JavaScript or through other parts of the, you know, other code. And one nice benefit of that is then you've built an API like that could be public, or you could expose parts of it publicly. Do you see that as something where people are able to take advantage of that?
I think that especially for a lot of public-facing websites, being able to open your system via various kinds of APIs to allow other systems to integrate in is very much a part of the business model. That's actually how you get more users, more information from other sites, get your information into other sites. So having that kind of API is very helpful. But scaling those kinds of APIs is sometimes more difficult than just dealing with regular users. See, regular users have a certain kind of predictable behavior to them that kind of fall into several buckets. That, again, when you're talking about large numbers of users, you kind of say, so you have sort of three gross groups that kind of behave this way, that one, another way. Once you get into an integration story with another website or another system or another company, the way that they use your API and the way that they generate load may be very different. So one of the things that a lot of companies end up doing is not just thinking about the API from a request response kind of way, but actually developing a more application-sensitive protocol. So you can see that if you try to integrate Google or if you try to integrate with Flickr, a lot of those places, if you want their data, some of them will give you a request response API, so kind of the people tend to call SOAP kind of endpoints. People think of them as web service endpoints. And a lot of times the impression is that's what service orientation is about. But it turns out that if you actually try to scale that, it's practically impossible, which is why those large companies, when they're looking at providing you with their data, by and large, if they'll give you that SOAP-based API, but they'll throttle you, so you can only perform, say, 1,000 requests a day, because they know that they just can't scale that. It's very difficult to scale synchronous blocking API calls. So that's why Google has their GData protocol, and that's why Flickr has their integration protocol, and Frenzied has theirs, where in order for you to get access to your data, you actually have to give them a URL where they will push their data to you. So it's very much a publish-subscribe kind of API, where you, as a subscriber to their data, give them an endpoint and say, please publish your updates to me here. In that way, they're able to batch and schedule the data pushes to the points in time which make the most sense for them, and really offload all the requests that would have been very difficult by large quantities of data to. So I'd say that while you can gain the benefits of SOA while still exposing your system's API to third parties, it does open sort of another set of scalability issues that, again, have well-known pattern solutions like PubSub kind of protocols in order to solve them. So it's nothing that developers should just assume works, just assume is scalable because you're using web services or because you're using REST or whatever the buzzword of the day is, and to understand that integration brings a new set of challenges, and that along with that often come a new set of patterns. Interestingly enough, they all continue to follow this this messaging style of one-way messaging, publish, subscribe, and offloading things and doing them in the background in an asynchronous way. It's the same patterns that have been scalable for decades and continue to carry us forward, even in this age of Twitter and Facebook and all those guys.
So I'm – oh, go ahead, Kevin.
Well, you mentioned something earlier about how developers will go to crazy lengths to do crazy things before they'll move to something like a messaging pattern. And I'm curious as to if you have an opinion as to why that is. I mean, why is PubSub sort of, or messaging patterns sort of not front and center in people's heads? Is it just an education thing? Is it a tooling thing? It definitely seems like it's considered sort of a slightly more exotic approach.
So I'd say the reason that developers don't start with messaging is probably an education issue. But the reason why when they run into scalability issues, they don't kind of move to messaging is because, to a very large extent, a lot of this stuff is counterintuitive. So synchronous request response kind of development is something you've got really good tool support for. All the samples with ASP.NET look that way. And the thing is, it works. So once you, as a developer, you've built a website, it works, you've got it online, users are using it, you feel like you're done. And then you get into slight performance issues, so you bang it a little bit on the side, and it kind of works out. And it works, and then it kind of slows down a little bit, and then you index your database, and it speeds up again. So it's this kind of, the system is done. It's that impression that I've got it done, or 99% done. It's just this little thing that I kind of got to tweak around the edges, and I can continue doing what I've always done. So it's probably just an issue of inertia and feeling at how close you are to having it fixed that kind of prevents people from taking that step to messaging. A lot of it, as I mentioned, is counterintuitive, because it's in essence saying, no, don't do it the way that you've done it before, do it this different way. And it looks quite different. That's really the thing. So that's probably the barrier that a lot of developers have. First of all, just knowing that it's out there. Second bit is tool support within Service Bus and related tools around that. I'm trying to get the tool support for these kinds of messaging patterns to be to the point where developers would feel quite a bit more comfortable adopting them. And the third part probably is that just ASP.NET, the samples that are out there, the kind of demos that people see at presentations and code camps and conferences, kind of keep showing the same things over and over again. And a lot of scalability conversations around ASP.NET are specifically around how do you scale ASP.NET rather than how do you build a scalable architecture and overall system, taking everything into account. So it's my hope that alongside the education, with better tool support, like in Service Bus, more developers will find it easier to adopt these kinds of architectures, these kinds of patterns, and then really gain the benefits of scalability.
And to what extent do you feel that, you know, I guess one of the things that seems scary about it is it sort of feels like, oh, I have to sort of start over. You know, I'm re-architecting my application now to sort of take advantage of this approach. Is that really true? I mean, can you sort of adapt to this thing incrementally? Or is it really sort of it is?
Well, the thing is that if you do all of the things that I've mentioned, kind of all together in one go, yes, the system will look very different from what you're doing today. But nobody says that you have to do that all at once. So that bit of rather than thinking of your web pages as a single monolithic page, but rather as a composite, that's kind of one step that you can take without making any other big architectural changes. Once you've taken that step, the kind of specifying caching for the different fragments is another small step. It doesn't require a great deal of re-architecture. The next step is to look at how can I set it up so that when users are typing something into my web app, that rather than going directly to the database, writing it there, and only when that's done, coming back to the user and saying, that's been successful, and refreshing the page, looking at queuing up a message that contains that information, and then just by a JavaScript telling the user, yeah, we've received your request, and it's pending authorization. We've kind of gotten used to that as users from things like Amazon. When you order a book, you get that thank you page. You don't actually expect synchronously the book to materialize out of your browser. Even when you order an ebook, a lot of times having that ebook delivered by email is perfectly acceptable. So a lot of users have kind of gotten used to this, getting the content or getting the things that they've requested by a different channel rather than the same web page that they've looked at. So making those kinds of changes maybe requires a larger step than the other two that I've talked about. But again, you don't have to do that for every single part of your app. Otherwise, it won't work. In other words, you can kind of take a very tactical approach and say, well, where do I get the most of the rights from? And maybe we'll take just that single use case of my app and introduce messaging there. So you don't, it's not a big bang re-architecture, throw away everything that you've always done, go back to zero. So you are able to really incrementally take a step, gain some benefits, try that out, get comfortable with it, take another step and go from there. After you do this iteratively, say over the course of 6 months to a year, you'll probably find that you've gotten comfortable with a very different kind of architecture than you were doing in the past. But it probably won't have felt like a big revolution in thinking, just be kind of minor evolutionary steps that you just did them over and over again. And you know, you got a more scalable system without having to refactor everything one go.
So I was wondering, Udi, you were talking earlier, you know, we were talking about some potential tooling things. I know and Service Bus is something that you work with. I'm wondering, Microsoft has been talking about .NET RIA services primarily for Silverlight. But, you know, then there's, I think that they've said that potentially it's a service system, so it could open up for, you know, ASP.NET or whatever. Have you looked at that? I don't know if that solves some kind of service communication issues at all.
Well, I have been following a lot of the new technologies that Microsoft puts out. In general, Microsoft, with what they're doing with the browser, is not really rethinking the kind of architecture that they were looking at supporting in the past. It's more about, let's call it a different kind of in-browser experience. The tooling that Microsoft continues to provide around building ASP.NET web pages and also .NET RIA applications is still very much oriented around the impression that you have a fairly direct connection from the browser to your server, and then kind of exploiting that direct connection for very tight integration. Whereas a lot of the patterns we've been discussing exploit intermediaries on the web between a browser and your servers to do stuff for you. So you don't actually own those intermediaries, but you can influence the kind of data that they return based on the URI space that you set up. So it's not something that I see as supporting the patterns that we've been talking about, but having more control over what goes on in the browser does allow us to, when we do choose to employ these patterns, that if we are conscious of the kind of architectural decisions we can make, we can give very good user experiences while maintaining scalability of the architecture and still giving that user a really interactive in-browser experience. But I do think that we do need to be very careful about things like how we separate personalized information from non-personalized information. If we take all that and kind of push it on the same pipe through .NET RIA services, we'll have all the scalability problems as we did with ASCOM.
Okay. And then, you know, while we're talking about other Microsoft initiatives and all that, of course, there's Azure and the idea of scalability through, you know, just adding on more and more servers. What's your opinion on Azure as a scalability system?
Well, Azure provides very useful and necessary infrastructure that if you have architected your system to be scalable, then you can exploit a lot of the features in Azure to further drive down the cost of that scalability. So, for example, let's say that you're a site like Stack Overflow, you have lots of users that are submitting comments and questions and answers and all that kind of stuff, and you're queuing those questions up. So from a browser perspective, the user thinks that their question has been submitted and is already available, but on your backend, it's actually queued up. So there you'd use something like Azure Queues in order to store those messages, and then you'd be using your Azure worker roles in order to feed off of those queues, process those messages, and go store them in your database or update those XML files we're talking about. So being able to have that kind of infrastructure around so you don't have to necessarily run this on your own servers allows you to exploit the asynchronous behavior of your architecture and be able to linearly add a whole lot more Azure workers in order to give you higher throughput. If you were to design your architecture in the old style of having, say, an Azure web role handle that web request and write it directly to a database, what you'll end up with is having that Azure database, eventually for concurrency reasons because everybody's kind of talking to the same tables, it becomes a choke point. So you won't be able to exploit the fact that you have the ability to increase drastically the number of Azure web roles because the Azure database really can't, it doesn't change database behavior. It just happens to be a database cloud. So I don't see Azure as a silver bullet. In other words, if you didn't architect for scalability, then Azure will give you scalability. It can't do that. What Azure can do is that if you did architect your system for scalability, you can write what's known as self-tuning applications. So let's say you have all of a sudden a burst of messages. Lots of users are becoming active on the site. Now, all these messages get queued up in your Azure queue. You can write a kind of monitoring process which looks at the wait time of messages in that queue. And if the wait time exceeds a certain threshold, you use the Azure APIs in order to spin up additional Azure workers so that you'll have more things feeding off of the queue. And if the wait time in the queue has decreased to less than a second, then maybe you can deprovision some of those Azure worker roles. Maybe you don't need nearly as many. So what you can create when you've architected your system in this way is a system that knows that, okay, we're under load, let's actually increase the number of resources and be able to handle that because we're doing it asynchronously in the background, or we're not under load anymore. So let's deprovision these servers, no reason to pay for servers that we're not using, and then we can really not worry so much about how many servers we need to run our system. The system will kind of figure out, based on what the users are doing at any given time, how many servers it needs. So having that kind of flexible infrastructure, like Azure, allows you to take this kind of architecture and make extremely effective, responsive, scalable websites at a fraction of the cost than if you actually try to build this sort of thing in-house, on-site, on your own servers.
So it seems like there's one other aspect, if I understand the keynote fluff that I saw the other day correctly on Azure, is that it will help with geographical distribution of your app. It sounded like they were going to roll out these computing containers that would contain, you know, your that would run your apps. And so instead of hitting you know, a data center in Rome, if you're in, you know, Japan, you may hit one in Okinawa. And of course, that's years down the road when they finally have these globally. But I was wondering, so I guess I'm curious about how you would handle scaling to geographical locations. So, you know, so one way that you can ensure synchronizing your databases correctly is to always have your writes go to a single data center and then have that replicate out, you know, for reads everywhere. That's one aspect. I don't know if, you know, what your opinion is on that, but so I don't know how you would scale your application geographically to, what am I trying to say, keep the data in sync. So if you spin up more instances, are you always guaranteed that those instances are going to be in the same location? And you know, how would that affect your architecture or your thinking in terms of writes, if not reads?
Okay, so when you're looking at a geographically distributed app, one of the reasons that we do that is for high availability. Often we also decrease the latency, as you mentioned, just in terms of less network hops from a user to actually access one of our servers. But really the big thing has to do with fault tolerance and high availability. So what that means is that we want to have our data in multiple locations, so that if one of the locations goes offline, that we will still have the data elsewhere. When it's not so much architecting for geographical distribution, but really understanding what kind of high availability you need. So when you write, when you're writing to say, and Microsoft will forgive me if I use the wrong marketing term, SQL Azure tables. So when you write to an SQL Azure table, you're not actually writing to a single location when it's geographically distributed. Your thread will lock as it writes to multiple geographic locations, so that if after writing to one of the locations, this data center goes offline, then the data will still exist in another place. You don't have to worry about the fact that you're counting on replication after the transaction is over. What this means is that you are inherently increasing the amount of time that a write takes in order to make sure that the write actually is copied to multiple places before your app assumes that it's been written. So we actually end up slowing down the writes in order to do geographic distribution, kind of what I mentioned at the beginning of this call. High availability means copying data to more places, which means slowing your system down. So being able to queue up these requests such that users don't actually end up waiting for this as a background process helps a lot. Usually it's the kind of thing that you don't need to worry about in your app, so you don't need to be overly concerned about the fact that it is geographically partitioned, because that just gives you the high availability. The question really is, if you want to get to the really highest levels of scale, understanding what's the number of locations that you need to write to. So in other words, if say we're talking about a tweet or something like that. So the goal is for all tweets to be written and to be highly available. However, what if at the time that a single user is doing the tweet, only two out of the three global data centers are accessible to your site? Does that mean that you reject the tweet, or that you accept the tweet and know that there is a chance that it will not be available in the case of a certain kind of failure? So really balancing the number of locations you need to write to, which is related to the availability of the data you're dealing with, versus the cost and the scalability impact, is something that companies that are building really the highest level scale, and here I'm talking about Amazon, eBay, that kind of level, they get into that level of I don't want to call it optimization, but that level of specification. Developers who build apps in those environments do need to specify when they're performing right, what is the level of resiliency that they require, because it really matters when trying to handle those scales. For most other developers, when working on the cloud, the fact that the cloud provides a globally redundant infrastructure will be largely transparent, though we may tend to see that latency per write increases as that happens. So we do need to be aware what that's going to be doing to the rest of our system. If we have designed our system as a chain of synchronous blocking calls, then having each call, each write, take twice as long as it's written to multiple global locations can cause really bad things for our system. When using message-based architectures where nothing actually blocks and everything else gets queued up, what we'll tend to see is that having writes take longer means that queues may get a little bit longer, but as we mentioned before, at that point in time, we can just provision more worker nodes that will feed off of that queue. So we'll be able to gain the high availability that the geographical distribution gives us, while by that asynchronous architecture still maintain the same levels of throughput and latency that our users have gotten used to.
Okay, Scott.
Hey, Udi. One of the components of Azure that Microsoft has been promoting has been the App Fabric Service Bus, and I was wondering if you looked at that enough to compare and contrast it with some of the current offerings that we already have that are available or in the open source community. Are they designed to solve the same problem?
So App Fabric, I guess we kind of need to tease apart what the marketing term is from what the technological stuff underneath it is.
Well, there's two points to it. There's the old Velocity framework, which is just a Memcached implementation kind of thing, and then there's the other half, which is the ethereal part that I couldn't glean from the marketing either. It seemed like it was going to be magic fairy dust that made your app scale perfectly within Azure.
Okay, so in a cloud-based environment, so say we look at Amazon with their EC2 environment. Amazon kind of gives you sort of from the metal up control of the machine that you're using within Amazon. The issue starts to become, how do you manage this environment over time? So in other words, when you're the one that's controlling really the Windows that is running on that box, it becomes your responsibility to patch it. And then how you actually go about rolling patches out across all of your Amazon EC2 instances and making sure that all of those patches are consistent with each other. And the same thing not only on a Windows level, but on your SQL Server level and on your .NET Framework level and then on your own application level is a very difficult problem from just operating a cloud-based application over a long period of time. So that's one of the things that Microsoft is providing with Azure, by not giving you really that lowest level of what's going on. It's able then to provide that level of fabric, such that your operational environment will continue to be, stable and consistent and reliable. And as developers, we don't need to worry about that. The caching part, is, there are lots of architectures that can definitely make use of a distributed cache, and there are a lot of them that do. But distributed caches are not magic fairy dust. They take up memory, they take up CPU cycles, and in the cloud, when you pay for machine CPU cycles and storage and bandwidth, having something like that out there, while it's useful, if you use it in the wrong way, it can end up being very expensive. And that's really the problem, that there hasn't been very much talk in terms of, well, what kind of objects do you put into this distributed cache? How do you keep them up to date when something in your database changes? Whose responsibility is that? If you update something in your cache, is it the cache's responsibility to write through to the database, or is that something that you're going to be doing yourself? So in that respect, it's not magic. It's a distributed caching product. get from Microsoft. There have been other distributed caches that have been out there in previous years. Some of them that run on the .NET platform, some of them on other platforms. There's enough industry knowledge and architectural experience in building apps with these things that a lot of anti-patterns have been identified. So it's really not going to be something that you sprinkle on top of an existing app that wasn't designed for it and that you'll get a benefit from it. Chances are it'll probably cost you more and it may even slow your system down. So there is a need to understand any kind of new technology, definitely if it's something that is that significant in your architecture before you go applying it blindly. So yes, it's very useful to have it. It's wonderful that we have it on the cloud, but I do expect to see more developers abusing it and getting bitten back by their choices than actually being successful with it right out of the box.
Dublin, that was the name of the other part of it. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I think we were talking about caching there, but I was wondering about the. I think it used to be called the .NET Service Bus, so now they rolled this into this App Fabric umbrella. But I was wondering if you've looked at like that compared to mass transit or N-Service Bus or something like that.
Okay, so let's start with the .NET Service Bus and then go to Dublin because it's kind of related to that. The .NET Service Bus provides for internet scale connectivity and relay. Where you may not have two endpoints which are visible to each other over the web. So one or both of them is behind a NAT, behind a firewall, and trying to set up communication between these endpoints is a difficult engineering challenge. Luckily for us, Microsoft came out with their .NET Services Bus, and that's really what it provides. It provides for that level of internet connectivity where you have two different endpoints that you can't say very much and you have very little control over what's actually going on between them beyond saying both of them are connected to the internet. That's the .NET Services Bus, as I understand it. There is the WCF binding for the .NET Services Bus, which allows you to build regular .NET applications using WCF, and then having these two machines use WCF, sort of a well-known approach to communicate while being sort of on two different sides of the internet and otherwise invisible to each other. So having that the .NET Services Bus binding for WCF solves that level of connectivity issues for building WCF applications. None of that is actually directly comparable to N-Service Bus or to Mass Transit or Rhino Service Bus or the other open source offerings. When we start looking at Dublin, or the project codenamed Dublin for Microsoft, which is the, as you could call it, something of an application server, which provides a certain level of hosting for WCF and workflow and your code that actually uses WCF and workflow together on-premise, then that's the place that we can start comparing that set of Microsoft technologies to something like N-Service Bus. Now, I don't want to turn this into a huge, gigantic comparison, because, you know, Dublin is fairly early technology that has been recently released and got an actual name. I don't remember exactly what it was. So one of its goals is to kind of take the next step with hosting and managing WCF and WF durable services. And that's kind of what it's after. In Service Bus, and I'll talk specifically about in Service Bus because that's what I know best. I don't want to put words in the mouths of any of the other open source projects. And Service Bus achieves many of the goals that Microsoft sets out to accomplish with WCF, WF, and Dublin, but takes a slightly different approach to it. So all the things that we talked about in sort of the first 45 minutes of our discussion was asynchronous architectures, queuing, one-way messaging, publish, subscribe. Those are the kinds of things that End Service Bus starts with. Those are really at the core of End Service Bus. You only do one-way messaging with End Service Bus. End Service Bus makes it very difficult for you to do synchronous blocking communication. It makes it easy for you to do PubSub. It provides you all the functionality for your subscribers to come and go, for your publisher to durably remember all the subscribers that were out there, to do polymorphic dispatch of events, do all sorts of really interesting, valuable things when you go down that path. When we look at the way that WCF approaches communication, WCF does not actually prevent developers from doing synchronous RPC-based communication. It's actually one of the supported, or dare I say even recommended approaches for using WCF. WCF also allows you to do one-way messaging and to use a queued technology underneath it in the form of MSNQ. But it tends to look somewhat similar to RPC-based communication. And a lot of developers, when faced with designing a WCF API, will default to really what's the easiest, more intuitive thing for them to do, which is to do kind of standard synchronous communication. And Service Bus kind of guides them away from that and provides them an alternative in the form of PubSub and one-way messaging. The next step that we can kind of look at the differences between WCF and WF durable services and in Service Bus is slightly related to that. So Workflow Foundation provides or has this way of hooking into WCF so that you're, in essence, exposing your workflow over WCF to other parties, and your code is really sort of a workflow, and that's how you represent your activities. Now, in WF activities, it's your responsibility to manage when you open transactions, how to catch exceptions, which exceptions are the kinds of things that you expect, which kinds of exceptions aren't, and then it's kind of your responsibility to handle those appropriately, and to build your workflow out of those kinds of activities. Developers that aren't extremely experienced in building highly reliable, transactional, thread-safe, scalable kind of infrastructure may make mistakes and get the activity nesting the wrong way, and as a result of that, end up with transaction boundaries that don't quite line up, and if their database throws a deadlock exception at them, that they won't remember that deadlock exceptions are actually to be expected, and that they should actually retry the transaction rather than just throwing all their work away. So there are all sorts of issues that developers are left to handle when building these kinds of solutions on WCF and WF. And Service Bus kind of comes with a very rigid approach that by default handles all of these. So exception managed transaction boundaries, deadlocks, retry logic, all that stuff is handled, and developers would have a very hard time in breaking that. So in Service Bus, the way that they'd write their workflow is using something called a saga. In sagas, you don't actually have activities. What you have is discrete handler methods. So anytime a message arrives at your endpoint, a transaction is started, the queue is read from, and then your code is invoked. Everything that you do in there is by default transactional, and any deadlock exceptions are immediately caught. And in that kind of way, developers are guided towards building scalable, robust, transactional endpoints kind of right out of the box. The final thing that I'd mention is that the in Service Bus host kind of packages all that up, makes it really easy for developers to take their code, install it as a Windows service, and manage it from there. And I'm guessing that would probably be similar to what Dublin provides on its end in terms of the Windows service hosting model of them. So I'd say that between the two of them, they're somewhat similar in terms of the features they go about providing, but in Service Bus tries to make it very difficult for developers to make mistakes just by not knowing and having the experience in building these apps. And Microsoft and WCF WF kind of give developers all the options available to do anything that they may want or may accidentally not want.
Awesome answer. Thanks.
You're welcome.
But, well, I mean, as far as my my question went, it's really that the .NET services bus is not the same, is not solving the same problem as these other pieces.
Right, right. Yep. So actually, we're looking in the next version of a service bus of building a transport for a service bus on top of .NET services bus, so that, you know, we've been receiving these requests all the time. People wanted to use a service bus from within Silverlight applications. So saying, well, we can't have MSQ inside Silverlight. Give us something else. So kind of putting a service bus on top of the .NET services bus is definitely something that we're looking at doing. We've already got several proofs of concept behind us, and we're hoping in the next version, which is version 2.1, of having that functionality available out of the box, so that you kind of get the best of both worlds.
Interesting.
Well, thanks a lot, Udi. I'm sure we could talk to you all day about this, but we need to wrap up. So do you have anything that you'd like to promote? Any speaking, writing, anything you'd like to talk about?
Well, I'm kind of all over the place these days. So I've just finished up my 5-day SOA course here in Paris. And Monday of, not this coming week, the week afterwards, I'm in Austin, Texas, giving the same course again down there. And I'm pretty much all over the place speaking at various conferences. So, you know, if you've been listening to this podcast and see me at one of those places, come up and say hi and have a chat about what you're doing in your architecture. I love hearing stories from people that have downloaded the service bus and got it into production within like 2 weeks and have just never had a problem with it afterwards. I love hearing stories. Please come and tell them to me. They never get old. That's really about it. Other than that, for people who, if this is the first time you've heard about InService Bus, you can go to www.inservicebus.com and you can download it. There's a fair amount of documentation, an active discussion group, and if you just like hearing about architecture and don't actually feel like using InService Bus, you can go to my blog, which is udidahan.com. That's udidahan.com, where I've got, I think, just about 600 blog posts on kind of architecture and scalability stuff that we spent this last hour talking about. So those are really the two best places to take the next step after listening to this podcast.
Great. Okay, thank you so much for your time, Udi.
My pleasure. Thanks for talking.
All right. That's all the time we have this week on Herding Code. We'll catch you next week.